welcome to our closing session. And I'm not Helen, I'm Karen. We're giving Helen a break now after that wonderful paper. So we're going to close what's been a great 2 days with questions, conclusions, and future directions. And we're going to ask each one of our participants, Shane Farrow, Andreas Lange, Henry Lowood, and Melanie Swalwell, to talk about challenges and opportunities. And by challenges, we mean in the sense of hard fun, which I think this group should understand. So can we begin with you, Shane?
Sure. Can you hear me okay? Well, firstly, I just would like to say I feel quite humbled to be on this panel. I'm speaking from a moving image archivist point of view, representing the New Zealand Film Archive. So we are partners on the Play It Again project, and I have kind of felt all the way along that I'm here to learn and pick up as much as I can from my colleagues, and really the big challenge for a moving image archive I feel has been coming to grips with this very different digital media in terms of game software, how we preserve that, how we continue that in a way that it is still going to be not necessarily playable, but is going to be able to connect with a future audience. And I feel that one aspect that is probably needs that moving image archives at least need to probably take heed of and look at maybe changing the balance. And that is, an archive essentially has three primary functions. It is a festival, an acquisition institution. It has a collection development function. It has a preservation, which is a subset of the collection management function. And thirdly, it has this responsibility to make the material accessible to the public. And it would be fair to say that moving image archives have very much often almost taken on a custodial caretaker role and been very, very good at the protection side and maintaining that their collections and trying to keep the integrity and duplicating to a high degree, but often at the cost of the public access to that collection. More and more, the perception that we're picking up is that the public aren't so much concerned with notions of authenticity, but they just want to know, how can I get access to this material that you hold? When are you going to put it online? Is a bit of a catch cry. And there's a whole heap of complexities and issues around that. But, you know, putting all that aside, I still feel that is the way we will have to move forward in the future. There has to be solutions. At the moment, we as a moving image archive already deal with a lot of born digital content. It is probably the primary state in which we receive donated material nowadays. It is born digital, and we have to deal with a lot of those images that Ross was bringing up in the in his talk about from the documentation Archives New Zealand perspective of how do we deal with all these unknown formats and these files that our system doesn't recognise. Well, you know, that is our world already. In the moving image archive world, we forever have had to cope with obsolete formats or proprietary formats that were around for such a short time. I don't know if anyone remembers the high density video, but we get these very obscure formats that last for a year or two in some cases. And yet we have to, we've been given the responsibility of transferring that material off there onto something contemporary. And I would suggest that moving away from the, you know, the analog world of with film is a relatively stable format for a long, long period of time, and we had a known way of dealing with that and migrating that. And there was kind of a perception that preservation was just doing this one-off migration onto a master format and making sure different level access copies, but essentially you did it once. I think more and more we have to recognise that preservation of this of born digital has to be an active process where it never actually stops. We just continue to migrate content onto new platforms, new containers. We have to set up systems that can handle that sort of requirement. So for instance, one of our strategies, we have very strong kind of bodies that, like the FIAF and ARMIA, bodies of archivists that think about and grapple with these issues all the time. And one suggestion for a standard proprietary format has been the JPEG 2000, and it's quite contentious between archivists. And so for the New Zealand Film Archive, one way we have gone is to put our preservation masters from original master sources onto either 16-bit or 10-bit uncompressed. So we're talking about huge files, 4.42, but they're absolutely massive. We put them into QuickTime containers. So, I mean, that's problematic, but it's a fairly global, generic container. And we then store those onto LTOs, which are a open source, a linear tape container. And that is one way that we're dealing with digital. But at the same time, we are very much aware that we need to look at all these other media and issues that surround software. So I just thought there's been a lot of really awesome points in this this conference, and one of them that's come up over and over has been the need to get all the contextual documentation as much as part of that preservation process. And that's certainly something that I think probably most archives strive to do already. But it has been, it's really hit home to me how important that those early conversations with the developers, the creators of the material, the fan communities. And I think one of the ways forward for archives is going to have to be collaborations with not just cultural heritage institutions, which has been the norm in the past, but more and more it needs to be with fan communities, with forums like this, with very different groups and organisations that have got different solutions to the to very similar issues. There has to be this open discussion and conversation that's ongoing. So I can give you one example that has been brilliant for us in terms of dealing with software migration, and that has been in New Zealand. A lot of the 80s games were probably dominated by the SC3000 gamers and that particular system, and there was upwards of 200 New Zealand games created. And we have managed to track down quite a few of those original 8-bit cassettes, there's a whole heap more that we don't even know whether we'll find originals. But the incredible work that a group called Sega Survivors did, and there was a Wellingtonian actually involved in that early group, Aaron Wheeler, they have just done an exemplary job of essentially preserving and making disk images of all those games and all the surrounding documentation and interviews. And so, you know, we have steadily harvested all the information on the site, but also have been able to get in touch with those guys and get the disc images. So for us, that just makes sense rather than necessarily trying to reproduce what has already gone before. And so I think, yeah, that has to be one of the key things, is just being open to following non-traditional collaboration.
Thank you. Can on that great note, because that is a big opportunity, can we hear from Andreas now? Thank you.
So our mission is to broaden the awareness about the cultural impact of computer games and to show the role they are playing in the digital revolution, and they are pretty much in the middle of it. And as a museum, you usually have two options to do that. One is exhibiting and the other one is collecting. And so let's come to exhibiting. We are very glad that we have almost 80,000 visitors a year, and that's shows that one is able to attract a broader audience, a broad audience with the culture of computer games. Of course, we are glad to be in Berlin. This is a great place to run such a museum, but we also are a little bit proud that we managed to do attract so many visitors as a privately held museum, so we are not supported regularly with public money. Coming to our other option, how we can fulfill our mission. So since our opening in 97, we continuously collected not only games, but also hardware, magazines, and a lot of items which also represent gaming culture, like posters and merchandise products and so on. And so this is something which is very ambitious if you are not only collect this and catalog it, and but if you want to give regular access to this, and if you want to preserve it for future generations. And this is a little bit more complicated than doing an exhibition, because to fund such things is almost impossible on a private base. So somehow here we need some external funding. And we need some other things. And one thing, for example, is that we have advanced the legal context. It starts with preserving, it's just saving. We need to transfer the games from their original data carriers. And of course, we have to handle the copy protections, which are on mostly of these data carriers. And yeah, somehow that's not allowed. Even if we are allowed to do a copy, but we are not allowed to circumvent a copyright protection mechanism. It's silly, but that's the law, and we have to advance this. And one step we did is that we found a European Federation of European Game Archives, Game Museums, and Game Preservation Projects to offer the lawmakers a compact interface for information about our needs. And hopefully, in some years, maybe in 5, maybe in 10, we will succeed, and we will get that extensions, exceptions, what we need, which we need to just save what we legally own. And then, of course, the next challenge is to give access. And there's also legal problems, but also problems related to the industry. It's a young industry, it's a dynamic industry, and we have a lot of orphaned works. And so if you want to give access to something which is IP owned, which is owned by people. Of course, we must make agreements, and if you have a lot of orphan works, it's not that easy to find that people to make agreements. And so here we need whether an initiative from the industry that they offer us an interface which we can give the fees we might charge for the access, a portion of that fees, and they will care to divide it towards the IP holders. That would be one option. Or we found legal argumentation which allows us maybe only for educational purposes to give access. And so to reach that, we thought it might be a good idea to join forces and found that federation. And this also represents something which Sean just right now pointed out, this different players which were brought together in the gaming industry, the community, and also the institutional players. So one, some of the members of AFGAMP, that's the name of this federation, are coming from the community, like the SPS society, which Christian Bartsch is representing, or the National Danish Library, which of course is a very established institutional player. And I think that's something where a lot of strength is lying in, and hopefully with such a combination we will manage to overcome all these obstacles. And maybe as a last comment, which is directly connected to how you can develop such a collection and how you can give access, and I mentioned it in a statement in the morning before, I think it's important to be aware that games are really pop culture. It's a global pop culture. And so thinking how you can fund such a challenge and such a project, like making such a big collection accessible, we should not only think how to give researchers and others what they need to also broaden the awareness about the cultural impact of computer games. We also should address users, because that would give us an option to maybe get more funding. And for that, of course, it's important to have the running games, to offer the running games, not only the documentary material. Of course, this is all important, but that's not in the main interest of the common user, of the common gamer. And so for us, it's also very important to set up systems which allow to play the game, even if they are old, even if they are done for obsolete systems. And so this is a technical challenge as well. But this is the area where I think where I'm mostly relaxed. But of course, giving access to multiplayer online games of today, this will also become, and still is, a technical challenge to virtualize all these payment systems and so on, to recreate the social interactions. But what else should I say? As let's try it, and we are confident that we will be able, using that platforms like the conference today, that we will get the critical mass of very different players to be able to fulfill that mission.
Thank you, and Henry.
Okay, so I'm thinking, well, one of the things we can do here is a challenge, right? Okay, so should I do it as a curator? Should I do it as a historian? I think I'm going to go a little different route, which is my personal reaction to the conference in some ways. And I should tell you that when you saw this stuff about SSG up there, I'm the guy on the other end of the Pacific who was buying their stuff. I still have a complete run of Run 5, and I'm also doing some work on it right now. So Let me give you two touch points for the challenge that I'm going to put out. The first touch point you've just heard about in a couple of the presentations, which is relates to SSG. I'm writing history of the technology known as the game engine. And one of the reasons that's an important history is that due to the architecture that the game engine after, let's say, Doom, you know, id's first-person shooters in the 1990s was given to us, the story goes, it made possible all of this user-generated content, right? Modified games, licensed games based on engines and all of that. And as a history of technology, I more or less subscribe to that. And I think that's Doom, for example, is an extremely important moment in the history of game technology. I'm also very aware of the fact that there's a little bit of overemphasis on this idea that player-generated content emerged entirely out of this technology. There were things that happened before. And one of the things that I had already lighted upon and was interested in pointing out was were the games that SSG put out in the 1980s. And you already know that part of the story, you just heard it, so I'm not going to rehearse that for you, but that's very important. Another little moment in this little story about player-generated content and the intelligence of players as a creative force from board games is a moment in the 1970s, also in Australia, and this is going to be where the challenge is going to go, a company called Jedco Games. And there was a guy there, John Edwards, who was a game distributor. Had a little bit of trouble getting all of these Avalon Hill games. You know, you saw the Avalon Hill General up there. He had a little trouble getting some of these games. He was not entirely satisfied with some of the classic Avalon Hill games like Stalingrad about the Eastern Front, and set about designing his own game. You could do that without Doom. You could do that with paper and pencil, right? You could say, I want to do a different version of this game. If you read what he said, there's a little bit of a tension there. You know, was he changing the Avalon Hill game? Was he doing his new game? Was he improving the game because Avalon Hill made some, you know, silly mistakes in their order of battle and that kind of thing? Anyway, he developed this game called the Russian Campaign, and the time that was left over from the hundreds of hours I spent playing SSG games was given over to games like the Russian Campaign and Fortress Europa that were designed by Jedco as board games in the 1970s, again, here in Australia. Another touch point, which I'll just mention, I won't go into it, another game company here in Australia is a company named Panther Games, which did both board games and computer games. My challenge, you know, it's really nice that I'm here to be able to make this challenge, is somebody tell me what was going on in Australia in the 1970s and 1980s as a historical context for this really vibrant game design culture that emerged here that had huge repercussions. Not everyone knew these were Australian game designers, mind you. I mean, a lot of people thought of the Russian Campaign as this Avalon Hill game, probably designed by somebody in Baltimore that they played. It was a quite popular game, particularly as a tournament game. So what was going on in Australia? I'd like to know much more about the scene in Australia, not just computer games, but also the board game scene, how the North American games were received here, who was playing, what kinds of things were going on. And I will say Melanie's next, but I have a feeling, knowing Melanie's work, about homebrew, about these weird computers that were developed here, because again, there were issues of access to these technologies coming out of North America and so forth that were spurring people to do their own projects here. I don't know if it's some kind of strange Australian independence that I really don't know enough about, or ingenuity, or what it is. I suspect there's some contextual things that need to be looked at here about economic factors and things like that, trade. Anyway, that's my challenge. Tell me more about the history of Australian games, because I'm dying to know.
Perfect segue. Melanie, thank That's you.
OK, well, this has been interesting to hear the challenge from Henry and Andreas's ideas about the future, and also the way that Shane perceives the challenges of the moment and the future. My idea for this panel was for everybody, like, to get a range of people up here who were from different kinds of institutions and get them to map out the sort of challenges that they saw and also where they saw the opportunities. So that's what I'm going to speak to, and they're all, you know, from the Film Archive, from the Computer Spiel Museum. Henry, you're the token Whatever, university yeah. archive kind of... Oh. No, not token.
Yeah, okay. I'm
very impressive I'll be a token university for once archive sure. representative. And so I'm the kind of misfit in a way because I'm from quite a different kind of institution, though obviously Henry's in a university as well. But I want to talk as a researcher. And I suppose the challenge that I see for the future is really in identifying the range of born digital materials that I think are, or that are culturally significant and historically significant, and figuring out ways, opening up dialogues with people so that we can make sure that these things, as much as is possible, are finding their way into appropriate homes so that we can build, to draw on the lovely concepts that Henry gave us in his keynote, both the software archive and the software library, so that these things persist or are documented at least. So that's kind of the challenge that I'm focused on for the future. And I think that I'm pretty optimistic. I think that we're at a really good moment and a really interesting point. So I think that the opportunities that exist are around having conversations with institutions and thinking outside the box about how we might be able to make this happen, considering distributed collections and custodianship arrangements, for instance. I think this conference has shown that there is goodwill and a willingness to start to have those conversations, and I'm really so heartened by that because, you know, we've come a long way from the days when I described this morning the tennis match between, no, it's not my concern, go and talk to somebody else, and then getting sent on to go and talk to somebody else. You know, I think we've gotten beyond that stage, and so that's a real achievement. I suppose, thinking about the Play It Again project. This conference is not about Play It Again. We had our day about Play It Again on Wednesday. But it's, I suppose, the ground from which I'm looking to go forward. And the model that we've used in that project, if you don't know, is to bring together a range of cultural institutions with university researchers with a range of skills and from a range of disciplines. And I think this is... something quite special about the Linkage Project scheme that we've been funded under, and that this can be a model that we can go back to and do again in different projects with different partners, as well as, you know, same partners. So that's, I suppose, my pitch. It means that, you know, memory institutions, for instance, that don't have the time in their day-to-day hours that they spend at work, or, you know, the staff... capacity, they don't have the capacity to spend, you know, a lot of time figuring out a complex problem. We can work in partnership with them and, you know, put a PhD student onto that problem who can then spend 3 years, for instance, figuring out a solution that's going to take things forward, and researchers who do the same thing. So that's sort of where I think I can contribute and where there are opportunities to be had.
I think, Melanie, you wanted to wrap up with a couple of just specified thank yous and greetings to all, and tell us where we're having a drink.
Yes, that's in short order, all in 3 minutes, because we do have to be out of here on time for another function that's bumping in, I believe, 15 minutes or so. So, yes, moving without any further ado, I will do the thank yous. ACME are obviously have been most generous hosts for the conference, and so I would like to invite you, yes, please, in particular, Tim Bright, the organizer who has made sure that it all hangs together and that things run smoothly. There's been a lot of emails back and forth over the last few weeks, finessing the program, organizing the video conferences. Can you believe that we had 4 video hookups and nothing fell over?
Yeah.
I mean, that's extraordinary. So, you know, thank you also to the AV technicians and the other staff who have supported us here in this really, really great venue. Other people at ACME who I should thank Russell Briggs, Gail McIndoo, and Helen Simonson from Public Programs. They've made this happen. The Play It Again team have supported me and made it possible to do this. And in particular, I'd like to acknowledge Angela Dalianis, the co-chair of this conference, who has been a wonderful sounding board and support. The one person who has really made it all happen is Liz Milford, our project manager. So please give her an acknowledgement. And Helen Stuckey, my wonderful colleague, collaborator and PhD student, who has also been a great source of inspiration and ideas and support. Thank you to all of you, the speakers and delegates, particularly those who've travelled from far away, but also the locals. It's been great that you've come to hear. Even if this isn't necessarily your area of specialty, it's been great that you've come to hear the range of papers on offer and to engage with the material that people have offered. To overseas people who've flown in, we know it's a really long way to come. Normally it's us on the other end of the world with the jet lag, so we really appreciate you making the effort. Special thanks to Henry Lord and Anne Laforêt for their wonderful keynotes. And really, let's go get a drink. Well, actually, I'm on a plane, so I probably won't get a chance to say goodbye to everybody, but thank you and goodbye, and let's keep the conversations going. You will be hearing from us before too long. We will be contacting you about publishing and also for feedback. It is our intention to also contact speakers to get permission to put the audio of the talks up, so that the conference can go on and have a life beyond, you know, these 2 days. So this isn't goodbye, just kind of, you know, till next time perhaps. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the after drinks are happening in Optic Bar downstairs at ACME. So anybody who wants to hang around and kick on, please do. Thanks, everyone.
Okay, and thanks, Melanie, very much.